This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
AI is making waves in every field it touches. President Biden is now on TikTok, and the election draws closer each day. With so much going on in the world, it is hard to keep up with it all, let me tell you. Hi, I'm Kai Ryssdal, the co-host of Make Me Smart. It's a podcast from Marketplace. And every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I break down the latest in business and the economy with short daily episodes to make it easy for you to stay in the know. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to Little Gold Men, the award season podcast from Vanity Fair.
It's such an honor to present this next award.
And here are the nominees.
And the Oscar goes to...
And the Oscar goes to...
And I can't deny the fact that you like me right now. You like me.
I'm the king of the world.
There's a mistake. Moonlight, you guys won Best Picture.
I'm Katie Ritchie, the deputy editor of VanityFair.com, and I'm here with a full house today. We've got our senior writer, Joanna Robinson.
Hello, Katie.
Our chief critic, Richard Lawson.
Hello.
Our digital director, Mike Hogan.
Hello.
And joining us to talk about two of the most fascinating movies of the fall, we've got our Hollywood editor, Hillary Busis.
Hi.
Welcome back, Hillary. You were the only person I thought who could really properly weigh in on Bohemian Rhapsody, which is out next week, the Rami Malek starring Freddie Mercury biopic. So we brought you in to talk about that, as well as Suspiria, which is out this week. And then from there, we're going to talk about some of the Oscar races that have us fascinated as everything continues to shift throughout award season. But I think we're going to start with Suspiria because it's out this week from Amazon. I think it's opening in two theaters, which seems to be Amazon's strategy. They roll things out incredibly slowly. And it has worked well for them in the past. I have not seen Suspiria. I've not seen the original Suspiria, so maybe I should just like sit in a corner for the rest of this conversation.
Face the wall, Katie.
I know. I sit in my shame. So Hillary, what is the deal with Suspiria? It seems fascinating, even if like if you're mean, you've seen the ad, you maybe totally don't understand it.
I've seen the movie and I don't totally understand it. So that just might be kind of what Suspiria does and is. Actually, I feel like Richard might be best to talk about it because Richard reviewed it and loved it. Like you gave it pretty much a glowing rave.
Yeah, I mean, but I think the thing about it is that it's really sort of what you put on the movie. You know, you could write any review and it could be about anything of that with that movie. Like Emily Yoshida from New York Magazine, a critic I really love. After I filed my review, I finally read hers from Venice and I was like, oh, we saw completely different movies and yet we both loved it. So it's just kind of a funny thing. And I think also, Katie, in terms of your shame, it's funny that all of a sudden we all are supposed to have seen this 41-year-old Italian horror movie. Like, it's like, that's a real, like, niche kind of thing. So I don't think anyone should feel guilty for not being familiar with Dario Argento's original.
Thank you, Richard.
I don't think anyone should feel guilty, but I don't think it's, like, quite as niche as you just painted it. Like, it's... If you're into horror, which I'm not, but if you are into horror, that is like a staple, like a cult classic. It's sort of become this thing. I don't feel bad. I've never seen it either. I actually plan to watch it this week. I don't feel bad for not having seen it. I don't think anyone should. And I talked to a bunch of like horror aficionados about it and they were all like, oh, I mean, if you see the new Suspiria and then you watch the old Suspiria, you'll be like, well, that movie didn't have much to say. Like, actually, the way my friend put it was, the old Suspiria didn't have much on its mind, whereas this new Suspiria, as Richard alluded to, like has so much to say that you could talk to a million different film critics and they'll have a different interpretation of it.
Yeah, I think the crucial thing about the new version versus the old is that, I mean, both of them take place in Berlin in the late 70s, but Luca Guadagnino, who directed the movie, really does a lot with that time and place and really investigates it in terms of its spot in history and what was going on, you know, 30 plus years after World War II. And I think that that adds a really interesting dimension to the movie where the original is much more just like spooky, you know, murder, like get away from the witch.
Is anybody kind of like talking about like like Nazi guilt or like survivor's guilt or is any of that on the surface in the original movie, which I also haven't seen?
Not that I remember. It's been a while, but I think that from what I could tell from this version, at least in my memory of the old version, like, this is much more explicit about all that stuff. And possibly to the detriment of a sort of, I mean, in a way, like feminist narrative with the movie where over the course of the film, a male character kind of moves to the center, though that male character is played by Tilda Swinton.
Spoiler alert.
Sorry. I feel like that's known, right?
No, it's at this point, they've given up the ghost.
It does point out one of the cool things, like I've been fascinated by the Tilda casting thing, and that basically there are no significant male parts in the movie, and she plays the only significant male character. It's an interesting twist. I don't know.
The only other male figures are these like policemen who get completely humiliated and debased, and I think that's it, literally. And so it's interesting because I did talk to the screenwriter at Fantastic Fest, and he was like, at that point, they weren't being explicit about who Tilda was playing, but he was like, we wanted to have no male point of view in this film. And so despite the fact that they have a male figure at the center.
And a male director, for the record.
And a male director and a male screenwriter, absolutely.
Give them their feminist trophy, perhaps.
Absolutely. They get, like, bronze, at least. But they put Tilda in that role so as to, like, not have a strong male point of view. But also, I think his point was they wanted a figure who was definitely an outsider of this world. And so since this world is so feminine, they wanted that male figure in there to feel completely outside of it. And I guess the last thing I'll say about this is like the original film, I know it's like a mystery of like, are these witches? Like, Are these witches or are they not? This movie's like, hey, guess what? From the top, they're witches. Why is that interesting? You know what I mean? And I think that's a much more, interesting, like, take on the whole thing.
Yeah, that's true. There isn't a mystery element, really. It's really just you. Any suspense is just you waiting for kind of all hell to break loose, which it does in spectacular fashion, obviously, at the end of the movie.
Yeah. I think the question is, I mean, like you said, Katie, the rollout is going to be slow and deliberate. But, you know, the comparison that I made in my review and that others have made is to Mother, which was a movie last fall that was similarly weird and alienating kind of horror from a sort of auteur-y director.
Artie.
Yeah, very, you know, and that movie was divisive. Hillary, I think you really liked that movie where I feel the opposite.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I think that it'll be interesting to see where Suspiria kind of falls on that spectrum. It's being released later in the year than Mother was. But it's also competing with big things like Halloween, which made near $80 million last weekend, you know. So I wonder how this movie will sort of play out in the discourse. I don't know.
Does it play at like a horror movie that you would go to see on Halloween if you were like a bunch of high school kids?
If you're a very pretentious high school kid.
Yeah. Okay. All right.
But I think it's less alienating than Mother, right? Like, I think that there's more to grab onto there than there was with Mother. Like, sound design alone is less alienating than Mother.
So if you're like a Hamilton kid, you go see Suspiria for Halloween.
you love Tilda. You want to see Tilda do three things at once. Why not go see it?
You want to learn how to pronounce Luca Guadagnino.
If you're a 17-year-old boy and you love doing theater and you've never had a girlfriend.
Right.
If you're Lucas Hedges in Lady Bird, then this is your favorite movie.
But actually, let's be frank. I'm sure there are some of those wonderful people in our audience. So should they bring a date or not? That's the real important question.
Well, I mean, it could be an interesting litmus test for a fledgling relationship. Like, okay. If you love it and they hate it, is that a sort of a sign of something? No.
I will say that there is less like weird sexuality than I thought there would be in the movie.
It's a pretty unsexual movie in a way. And I think that that's part and parcel with the sort of monogender kind of like approach to the film.
I was kind of expecting it to be like The Favorite, honestly. And there's like none of that.
Yeah.
There's no subtext. There's no text.
No, there's one line that sort of references it, but that's kind of it. So yeah, I don't know that it's like necessarily the date night movie for Halloween, but I think it could be the, you know, if you want to kind of feel smarter than your friends and, you know, and because that's the thing, a movie like this that's so abstract in its kind of intention, you can graft anything onto it. You can be a genius in a million ways, like, because you can be like, no, it's actually about this or it's about this. And the funny thing is, you're not really wrong.
Yeah.
Okay, that's perfect.
There are a couple of really gory moments, which I just want to like point out.
There's one sequence in particular, like about halfway through the film, that's
I was like clutching my face. Yeah. It was horrible.
It's pretty brutal. So just be, you know, buyer beware about that. But you can just cover your eyes, you know.
Cover your date's eyes.
And you have to cover your ears because there's a lot of bones cracking.
Just leave the theater. Go get a popcorn.
Oh, boy.
It's just that one, though. Like, someone asked me if it was gory, and I wouldn't call it gory except for that one scene, which
is the most gory thing I've ever seen.
Yes,
which will live in my nightmares forever.
So the next obvious question I think about which audiences will receive it, is there a reason to keep this in the Oscar conversation, or is it going to be like Mother, where it's fascinating and people like talking about it, but the awards campaign never comes together?
I think its biggest play in that world is that it has a celebrity composer for its score in Thom Yorke from Radiohead. And the score is really evocative and interesting. And, you know, in much the same way that like Trent Reznor has been doing interesting film scores, or Johnny Greenwood from Radiohead has been doing a lot of great film scores for the past like decade or so. So I think that could get in there. I mean, it looks great. There are some technical things, but I think that
cinematography.
Yeah, I think that that's about there. But like, it also has a lot of competition. So maybe score with, again, a big name, that could be its big chance.
If we were in the days when there was an Oscar for choreography, it would have that all sewn up.
Yeah, for sure.
Did there used to be an Oscar for choreography?
Did there? Maybe I made that up. I thought that maybe in the days when there were musicals, like when there were enough musicals, I think that was maybe in the conversation. Maybe I'm thinking of the Globes.
Well, the Globes will always be able to make their own rules. So we can't hold out hope for like a Tilda Dark Horse campaign or anything like that?
I mean, maybe she's playing three roles, so like maybe in supporting, I don't know.
That third role's a spoiler, Joanna.
I don't consider it a spoiler.
It's out there.
You're like, there she is again. Okay, hi Tilda, again.
It's listed on her IMDb, like on the movie's IMDb cast list, all of the roles that Tilda Swinton is playing. So if you don't want to know anything more, then don't read that.
Also, if you've got Tilda, you may as well use her again.
Well, exactly. Yeah. Someone on Twitter said that the headline of the review, which mentions witches, which I'd asked you, Hillary, before we published, they said it was a spoiler. And I was like, again, this movie's been out for 40 years. I mean, there was some version of it. Like, we all know it's about witches. Come on.
I'm Chris Murphy.
I'm Richard Lawson.
And I'm Hillary Busis. We are from Vanity Fair's Still Watching podcast. Next up, we're watching the new HBO show, The Regime.
Madam Chancellor, let's keep the gloves on.
This is not a confrontation. We're just saying what's true.
Academy Award winner Kate Winslet is our chancellor as she leads a faux European autocracy in turmoil.
We'll be watching week by week as the regime unravels.
And we'll be talking to the stars along the way.
New episodes of Still Watching will drop every Sunday after the regime airs.
This message comes from Apple Card. Earn up to 3% daily cash back on every purchase, every day. Then grow it at 4.50%. Annual percentage yield when you open a savings account with Apple Card. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card subject to credit approval. Savings available to Apple Card owners subject to eligibility. Savings accounts provided by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, member FDIC. Terms apply.
Well, talking about another movie that we all know the ending to, although I actually have no idea how the movie handles this particular ending, Bohemian Rhapsody, the Freddie Mercury biopic that has been mired in controversy, I guess not since it began, but at least since its director, Bryan Singer, was fired halfway through production. It's out next week. Hillary, I believe you're the only one of us who's seen it, so we brought you in as our sage guide to the world of Freddie Mercury and Bohemian Rhapsody. From what I can tell, you're kind of fascinated by this movie, even if you don't like it at all.
Yeah, it's a bizarre movie in every way. It's like Walk Hard, Played Straight, which is nuts. Like, it's a biopic about a musician made as though there have not been 50 million other biopics about musicians that are all exactly the same. Like, it hits every single cliched note. And it's rated PG-13, which is crazy because it's a movie about a rock band in the 70s and 80s, and there is no drug use or nudity or swearing. So the movie is executive produced by two surviving members of the band, Brian May and Roger Taylor, and it seems as though they kind of dictated what material would be permitted to be included and what wouldn't. I mean, I guess as is usually the case when, you know, real people are involved in a movie about them. But because of that, I think that it has this slant that's really weird. It's like kind of selling itself as a Freddie Mercury biopic, but the movie is very concerned with making sure every member of Queen like gets credit for the things that they did. Like, there is this scene where Freddie is complaining about something and he's like, and I didn't even write that song. Like, you did the riff, right? Like, Roger, and like the drum was all you, Brian. And it's just like so awkward. And like, and so much of the movie also is like, to go back to Walk Hard, you know that part in Walk Hard where he's like meeting the Beatles and it's like Paul Rudd and Jason Schwartzman and like somebody is like, what do you think, George Harrison of the Beatles? Like, that's the whole movie.
right,
just very awkwardly shoehorning in like, hey, here's a thing that you know, like, let's mention it so that you can feel smart and we're foreshadowing like the moment where we play it on the stage.
Does anyone play, is anyone good at playing like 70s rock stars? Like, is there a good Bowie or Elton John or something?
There isn't a Bowie, which I was really disappointed by. They don't have have an under
pressure scene. The surviving members of Queen are just like, let's pretend Bowie never existed.
Kind of. Oh man, that reminds me.
Overshadowed us.
My very favorite thing that happens in the movie is, so the whole thing is kind of built around Queen's big Live Aid performance in 1985, which was, I didn't really appreciate before I saw it, kind of how big of a deal in music history this is, especially if you're British and you care about rock. Like, this was the biggest concert ever in the world, and Queen's performance was amazing, and they hadn't performed live in a while, and it was big and triumphant. And so they're leading up to that, and the band is talking about, like, all of the other bands that are supposed to play at Live Aid, and they're like, everybody's going to be there, like, Paul McCartney, Mick Jagger, U2, Bob Dylan, REO Speedwagon.
Yes.
REO Speedwagon was also a producer on the film.
Right. Yeah. I'm fascinated by this PG-13 thing. Do you think they were just like, it should be a family movie? You know?
Yeah, obviously, like, obviously Queen is a family band.
Right, yeah. They've probably got kids and grandkids now. They're like, oh, I need them to see it.
Yeah, well, and that actually, it brings up another really weird and bad thing about this movie is that it kind of paints all of the members of Queen except for Freddie Mercury as these like straight-laced family men. Like, there's a moment where like sad Freddie Mercury, who is like, you know, not out publicly, but everybody in his life knows that he's gay, and he's like been like kind of there's this predatory manager who has kind of seduced him into this like hedonistic lifestyle, and Freddie is getting sad and he like looks around at his bandmates and he's like, you all have wives and families, what do I have? Which is like, whoa.
Oh,
yeah,
cool.
So like there's this weird homophobic strain in it. Like, it doesn't mean maybe to blame like him being gay for like his downfall and like getting AIDS, but it kind of seems like it does. Like, it very much associates like being gay with this like, you know, partying lifestyle, and like no other members of the band are ever like doing drugs or cheating on their wives, but Freddie Mercury is.
Well, it's interesting because I feel like some of Queen's music, like We Are the Champions or We Will Rock You or whatever, like that stuff that's been so, you know, taken in welcomely by like straight men who want to be at sports
jock rock
kind of thing, and yet at root of it is this flamboyant queer man who, like, you know, and I think that there's been an effort over the years to sort of push that narrative out of Queen's music, or some of it anyway, and it feels like that movie is then kind of carrying water for that mission, which is a weird thing considering, and albeit one with a very problematic personal life from all we understand, was directed by a gay man, so for the most of the production, you know. So it's just weird that like that I think that kind of what you're alluding to, Hillary, is it feels like, was this movie made in like 1992? Like, it feels very retrograde.
Yeah, there's this weird tension. And it also, as I guess any like fact-based movie would, in order to create dramatic tension and whatever, I mean, it changes the facts a lot. Like, most egregiously, I think it has Freddie Mercury realizing that, like, getting diagnosed with AIDS, then like getting back together with the band that he has left because he wanted to have this solo career, like kind of pushed by this predatory manager guy, and then he gets diagnosed and kind of sees the error of his ways and goes back to his friends, and they like have this triumphant concert. But in real life, Queen never broke up, at least publicly. Freddie Mercury was not the first person in the band to make a solo album or try to do a solo career. He was preceded by at least two other band members, and he wasn't diagnosed with AIDS until 1987, and Live Aid was in 1985. So like, it's really like kind of creating this narrative in order to like justify itself, when like there's a real story that would have been as interesting, if not more interesting, if they had actually done that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think it makes me curious. Well, I'm curious about two things. First is, like, will the Elton John movie suffer the same thing, Rocketman, which is, like, bizarrely, like, a May release.
And is directed by the guy who took over for Bohemian Rhapsody, right?
Yes.
Oh, right, yeah.
But Elton's alive, so he can be like, no, this is a story about how great I am, not how great Bernie right, Taupin.
Not Bernie Taupin.
I have control over this. But my other question for you, Hillary, is, so I've heard similar things from other people about the film, but a lot of those same people are saying, but Rami Malek's really good. So do you think he's good enough to kind of transcend a pretty bad rote biopic?
You know, I'm not really sure. I think a lot of people like Rami Malek and want to not just completely tear the movie apart. I think that he does what he can. He is saddled with this ridiculous set of fake teeth that is just very distracting and, like, affects the way that he speaks. He doesn't do his own singing most of the time. I think that they claim that that his voice is, like, in the mix in some of the songs, but, like, listening to them as somebody who has listened to a fair amount of Queen, like, the songs in the movie sound basically exactly like the real Queen tracks. Like, I'm not really sure how much singing was involved. And if you're an actor playing a singer, I think that you get more credit if you sing, or rather than just lip syncing. So yeah, he's good. Like, I don't know if he's good enough to transcend everything around him.
Yeah. I mean, he has goodwill towards him, but maybe it's not quite.
Exactly.
Enough.
And the fact that it's not competing as a musical at the Golden Globes, which felt really obvious, like a way for him to get in for Best Actor in a Musical or Comedy, like that seemed to kind of shoot the awards chances it had in the foot.
Although the Hollywood Foreign Press ultimately makes that decision.
Oh, do they?
Know, a studio can, like, heavily say what their preference is, like with Star is Born's going drama too, but, like, ultimately it's up to the HFPA. So then maybe they'll decide at the last, you know.
Yeah, if they want awards, then it is crazy for them to even submit this movie as a drama.
Yeah.
I mean, if Val Kilmer didn't win the Oscar for The Doors, I don't know, you know, what people expect.
Like this relitigation.
What do you think, Jim Morrison of The Doors?
Hillary's reaction justifies everything that, like, I think a lot of us have been feeling for a long time, which is, like, this has felt like a cursed project since the beginning, because, like, we had many actors cycle through, many directors cycle through, Sacha Baron Cohen, Ben Whishaw, like, all this up. Like, I feel like I can track my time at Vanity Fair by, like, trade news stories I wrote about Bohemian Rhapsody. But my favorite quote from Sacha Baron Cohen when he was, like, off the project and just, like, throwing all kinds of salt on the project afterwards is he said that the band thought that the movie, like, Freddie Mercury should die midway through the movie, and the back half of the movie should be about how the band triumphed, like, without him. And he was like, I should have listened to the warning signs then, is what Sacha Baron Cohen said. So it's like, it just, like, yes, that's essentially, like, you know, Freddie Mercury doesn't die midway through, but this is a movie about how great the rest of Queen is, which is just not as advertised, you know? So
yeah, totally. And you actually reminded me, Joanna, of another amazing, ridiculous thing about the movie, which is Mike Myers appears. Mike Myers is like an in-joke that his casting, because Wayne's World kind of brought Queen and specifically Bohemian Rhapsody back into, like, pop culture in the 90s. And so Mike Myers appears as a record executive who hates Bohemian Rhapsody, the song, like, doesn't want to release it, thinks that it's garbage. It's like, nobody will ever be, like, headbanging to this on the radio.
No,
and
just,
like,
man.
Really? Oh, yeah, it is so cringeworthy. So Bohemian Rhapsody comes out anyway, and it's, you know, a monster hit, whatever. But as, like, the band is playing it on the stage, the movie has this, like succession of, like, headlines from, like, reviews of Bohemian Rhapsody that, like, flash across the screen.
Is it spinning newspapers?
It's basically that, but it's all like this song is garbage, Rolling Stone, like, loud and pretentious, the New York Times, like, just them taking this, like, really obnoxious victory lap in a really, like, oh God, it's so bad, you guys. This movie is so bad.
Well, what the world needs in 2018 and what, in fact, people are demanding is a Wayne's World joke.
God, and then I'm going to spoil the end of the movie. And then, so the last 15 or 20 minutes is just basically a shot-for-shot recreation of Queen at Live Aid. Like, they do almost the entire set that the band played at Live Aid, which is crazy because that video exists. You can just watch it if you want to see that. You don't have to pay $19 to see it in a movie theater. So they sing We Are the Champions, and on the line, No Time for Losers, it flashes back to Mike Myers, still sitting in his office, lamenting how he's the man who let Queen get away.
He's the loser. Did you get
that? He's the loser.
That? Yeah.
It's basically Merry Christmas to everyone, including the haters and losers.
Oh, man. Wow. Yeah, there's something Trumpy.
Yeah.
For sure.
And I think what the world is demanding in 2018 is just a giant, expensive, like, justification for a bunch of rich old white guys who used to be on top of the world in the 80s.
Yeah, they have this whole thing about how, like, Queen is a band of misfits, like, making music for misfits. And it's, oh, my God, shut up, you guys.
Do we want to talk about the Bryan Singer of this? He's the director. He's the credited director on this. He has been hired for more projects despite some, you know, years worth of allegations of misconduct against him. I don't want to like say anything that's going to get us legally in trouble, but it's another added wrinkle that makes this movie seem so weird that it's partly directed by Bryan Singer.
Yeah, and you can kind of tell that at least for a significant amount of filming, there was somebody else at the helm. It's like it's choppy. It's kind of awkwardly spliced together. There's all the scenes with just like a whole lot of cuts because it seems like they didn't have a lot of footage to work with. You can tell, I think, watching it, that there was a lot of behind the scenes drama.
I mean, Singer is such a tricky subject for various reasons. And, you know, when Me Too began, a lot of people were like, OK, well, that's particularly when Kevin Spacey went down. But it hasn't happened. And you know, people have tried and there have been legal things against him. There was a documentary that was sort of ended up not really, a lot of stuff got cut from it because someone recanted. So I don't know. It's a tricky thing. And I think it's bedeviling that like people still are hiring him for big things. I wonder, though, like how long a narrative that actually is going to be, because this movie seems to be something of a flop.
It could make money.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah. I mean, I don't know.
From the heartland of the Bay Area report is that a lot of people are really excited for this because they cut that trailer really well. And there's a lot of goodwill for Rami Malek from Mr. Robot. And I basically I've been cautioning friends not to see it, like actively throwing cold water on it. But like, I can't convince everyone in the Bay Area not to see it. So I think it is going to make money, at least on opening weekend. And then we'll see what happens.
There is a so bad it's good element to it. If that's your jam, if you want to wait until it's streaming somewhere and watch it then, I think that would be perfectly reasonable. But yeah, I don't spend money to see it opening weekend.
Yeah, I really want to see it. You guys haven't stopped me.
And then I can't wait to talk about it with you and just hear all of your favorite bad, terrible moments.
So we're going to spend the rest of the show talking about more of the Oscar races that have us fascinated. And as always, it seems to come back to Best Actress because, I don't know, that's where our hearts lie. And Richard, you actually had an interesting, like a Best Actress moment or revelation at the Middleburg Film Festival over the weekend. What did you see and what struck you about it?
The festival brought me down. I did a Q&A and they just wanted me to see what the festival is. It's 6 years old. It was started by the woman who founded BET and now owns this resort out like an hour outside of D.C. And it's a beautiful setting. And then the festival gets good movies because they can afford them.
Her life sounds amazing.
Yeah. No, I mean, she's a fascinating story. So you know, they wanted me to kind of just see what it was all about. It's just a weekend festival, kind of like Telluride. You know, it was me talking to a lot of rich people in line.
It's another day in the life of Richard.
Yeah, you know. But the Q&A I did was with Peter Hedges, the writer and director of Ben Is Back, which I think we spoke about after Toronto, which is a movie about the opioid crisis, in particular one family dealing with it. Lucas Hedges, Peter's son, plays the afflicted kid, where Julia Roberts plays his mom. The movie went over a treat at the festival, and Julia was not there, but people I spoke to were very high on her and the movie and its timeliness. And I think it's interesting to talk to people like the people at Middleburg, because I don't think that they're Academy voters. Although I did talk to some producers and film, you know, people who could be, but they represent something of a similar demographic. Socioeconomically, age-wise, I think that their passion for that movie, for me, moves Julia Roberts more into the kind of like theoretical five.
Yeah. Well, and not to promote a competitor here, but Scott Feinberg does keep a very good list of, you know, who's in the mix. And he's got Julia in his five front runners with Glenn Close, Olivia Colman, Lady Gaga, and Yalitza Aparicio. I mean, it's not a bad list. There's a lot of other great performances, but that doesn't sound wrong.
I wanted to ask you guys about the Glenn Close narrative, because I know it's something that we've been talking about for a while, but I'm curious where exactly this is popping from, because her film wasn't exactly like in the heat of the festival circuit. So where is this Glenn Close noise coming from? How did I miss it?
Well, something that I took note of is we are just entering screener season, where movies are getting sent out to people so they can watch at home and don't have to drag themselves to whatever. RBG, I think, was the first screener that went out, but the second one was The Wife. Which, you know, is the Glenn Close movie. And so they're it's in people's consciousness. The other thing is she's winning the big award, the Santa Barbara Film Festival, which I believe, you know, later this year or early next year.
I think
year.
It happens like right after the Golden Globes, somewhere in that range.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So like that's a thing that's a sign that the industry is keeping that performance in mind. So for whatever reason, I mean, it premiered at Toronto over a year ago. And then had a kind of quiet-ish August release. It made some money, but not a ton. But the power of Glenn has just like kept that movie, particularly that performance, lingering. And I think that Sony Pictures Classics is keen to that and has been handling
that's
well.
That's so fascinating. So like, is the wisdom that she's going to like definitely feels so sure that she's going to be nominated, but like, how could she possibly win for a performance that so little, despite her being Glenn Close and being amazing and having all these near misses in her career and stuff like that? Like, how can she win for a film that like, or a role that not many people in the world have seen, frankly?
Lest we forget, Meryl won for The Iron Lady.
Yeah, fair enough.
Acting wins come from weird places, because it's so much more about the people and the narratives around them. And Glenn Close has this undeniable narrative where she's never won before. It does seem tougher for her when you've got Lady Gaga, who's in this juggernaut that's A Star Is Born. But as we've talked about, there's kind of like legitimate reasons to think maybe it won't happen for her, because it's her first major performance. So if I were Glenn Close's people, I would consider like it very much still within reach.
Yeah, I mean, I think that you look at a movie like Still Alice, which not a lot of people saw, but that Julianne Moore rode a wave of good notices for it to a win, because it felt like it was her time. And I think that people are really into that narrative a lot of the, you know, and with Glenn Close, like, this would be her seventh nomination, five of which were in the 80s. She got one in 2011, I think, for Albert Nobbs. So there's a kind of, and she's also been doing a lot of theater recently. She came back and did Sunset Boulevard. She's in a show at The Public where she plays Joan of Arc's mom right now. Like, Glenn Close is having a sort of resurgence, and the timing just syncs up.
Look, it's 8,000 people, you know, and they can kind of basically decide in July, like, we're giving this to Glenn this year. Yeah. You know, they basically can do that, sort of. You know what I mean? Like, when they see it, they're like, oh, finally, like, this will be our opportunity to make this happen for her. This movie's good enough. Like, basically spread the word.
I guess I'm just wondering, and like, I might be speaking totally of ignorance here, but I guess I'm wondering if this like new Academy class that we're touting, and this like Academy that really wishes it had a popular film Oscar category this year, but maybe we'll try to skew more populist without that category, if that's still the Academy that would award Glenn Close for a film that not that many people saw.
Yeah.
That's a good question.
Right. I shouldn't say, I mean, that's fair. And I think, you know, there's an old school clique in the Academy, and then there's a big new onrush of probably 2,000 people who aren't part of that thing. And so there's a push and pull there. And I do think, you know, I don't think it's like Olivia Colman and Lady Gaga have no shot, or Julia Roberts or whomever.
Right.
But I think that we would be wrong to underestimate their ability to basically kind of say, like, we're doing this for Glenn.
Yeah, that's a good point.
You know?
We should talk about Olivia Colman, since I think they announced that they were officially planning to campaign her as lead, like, after we recorded last week. We've talked about this, and Richard, I think you've made it pretty clear that you think if she was in supporting, she would win for sure, and Best Actress is riskier. Now that we're stuck with it, I mean, do we think she has a chance in Best Actress? I kind of think she does.
Depending on when the voting kind of window is and when the show is out, like, it'll help that she's playing Queen Elizabeth on the Crown, you know, a huge Netflix show. She's taking over for Claire Foy in a beloved role, you know, so Colman will be on people's minds. And I think that can help sometimes. I mean, I'm thinking about like Melissa McCarthy winning an Emmy for Mike and Molly, which she really won for Bridesmaids. And that was, you know, a TV thing that was a different sort of animal than the Oscars. But I don't know. I think that Colman is possible. I will say, though, that going, you know, back to the Middleburg Film Festival and also going back to Telluride, talking to people about The Favorite, a lot of those older rich white people were like, it was weird. I don't like it.
It is weird.
And they didn't mean that in a good way.
Yeah.
So I think and they can all respect the fact that, like, they've seen Olivia Colman in Broadchurch and they like her in that, or they like her in whatever. But, like, that's not the movie for
Manager.
Them.
Right. And for us, it's like, well, it's less weird than The Lobster. But for some other folks, they're like, still really weird.
Yeah. And that can be alienating. And I think that while we do have an academy that nominates The Lobster for a screenplay award, or, you know, recognizes some smaller, quirkier stuff here and there, it's hard for that stuff to win.
Yes. It's hard, you know, for the big awards, it tends to be the heart stuff, right? Or those kind of like it's time moments. So we'll see.
And I think that it's time thing, if you look at, like, if we want to position that the trifecta being Olivia Colman, Lady Gaga, and Glenn Close,
mm-hmm.
Olivia Colman doesn't get it because the movie's too weird and mm-hmm. she's not quite famous enough.
Yeah.
Lady Gaga doesn't get it because a lot of people are going to be like, oh, her, the pop singer? No, you know?
Right.
Like it's not the same thing as Cher winning for Moonstruck. It's a different sort of movie. It's a different sort of pop star, frankly. So take those two away, and then you have this, like, safe, like, no one is going to object to Glenn Close winning an Oscar, finally.
Yeah. Well, the other thing that people will be able to say about Lady Gaga is, like, she's playing herself. Right. So at some level, you know? So if, like, let's see her play something else, and then we can talk about whether there's an Oscar down the line, but, like, Glenn Close with 7 nominations and no wins, that does become an easy maneuver. Wow, we just talked ourselves not only into her being nominated, but winning. That didn't take long.
It's not my intention. Though I would love a win for Glenn Close, who rules and is great and deserves it. So that would be fine. One last question I want to ask in this category is Melissa McCarthy. I know that, Richard, you talked about her film in the context, I think, more largely of Richard E. Grant. But what do we think about Melissa McCarthy getting a Best Actress nomination at the Oscars?
It seems pretty possible to me.
Yeah.
Like, there's so much affection for that movie that keeps building, it feels like, as it goes along. And like we were talking about last week, like, you know, Richard's a fan, like, Richard E. Grant is getting this Best for Supporting Actor, so they kind of, like, lift each other's coattails as they go along. I mean, Best Actress feels crowded, as it often does. So, like, you know, there's a lot of, like, 4, 5, and 6 position people who you can see swapping around who aren't Lady Gaga or Glenn Close. But, I mean, I would think she's still pretty much in the running.
Yeah, I think it's been heartening. That movie was released last week, but in a very small capacity. It'll grow. But it's been heartening to see how much sort of, not grassroots, but like small scale support that's kind of grown, you know, as the weeks have gone on for that movie. Because it's really good. It's really small. It's a very specific story. I think that, like, I don't know what the ratio is, but like whatever New York Academy members there are, you know, the Peggy Siegel kind of people, they'll really like that movie because it's so New York-y, and it's kind of, it honors a sort of throwback wit and you know, Dorothy Parker and Fanny Bryce and all this stuff. It has a sort of, I could see an older New York dwelling Academy voter being like, oh, this movie cares about what I care about, you know, and thus giving Melissa McCarthy a nomination. I think it's probably too small for Best Picture, but I think those two performances are, I would be surprised if either of them didn't get nominated.
I actually had one last question in this category, too, because a lot of people in Gold Derby are keeping Yalitza Aparicio from Roma in their running. And that would be an uncommon but not unheard of nomination for someone who's never acted before, who isn't really an actress. Like, they do kind of love it when women pop up from out of nowhere and give kind of striking performances. I'm thinking of really mostly children, like Evangeline Wallace in Beasts of the Southern Wild is the first example that comes to mind. It also seems challenging. We've talked about the challenges of Roma as a Netflix movie that's really needs to be seen on the big screen. It's pretty arty. I feel like a skeptic about this one just because there's so many big famous names with big narratives behind it. But are you guys believers in Yalitza?
I feel like she's kind of that would be an interesting sign of a broader support for that movie.
Yeah.
You know, again, talking with people in the horse country of Virginia, they liked the movie, but it was not, I think they felt similar to that you did, Katie, where they were like, they didn't quite connect mm-hmm. to it. And so if they're not connecting with it as a broader kind of work of art, are they then going to take this pretty, you know, unadorned performance from a non-professional actor and say, yes, that should be, you know, I don't know. I'm much more skeptical about her chances than other people seem to be.
I think that's all correct, but I also think that a lot of people do really connect with the movie and love it. And then there's like, I do think there will be a dynamic of sort of like liberal, like, we have to give that nomination, you know, which for whatever one may think of it, I think we'll push in the other direction too. I think there will be some obligatory, like, yes, come on, let's all rally and make this happen. So I don't know if that gets her across the finish line or not, but I think that that would be a counterbalance to some people just not really loving it as much as I did when I saw it.
It's going to be someone's senior thesis is like Mexican filmmakers at the Oscars in the Trump era, and like why, you know, like if Shape of Water did well and then Roma does well, it's like, well, Trump made his vote for all the Mexican directors more than we might have otherwise.
Well, they had a several year run up in the Obama.
Oh yeah, of course. No, yeah. You know, Reach has been doing it. It's a flawed thesis, but it is interesting that this is the second year in a row we've had a major Mexican director, and it's like, well, you know, the more Trump rails against Mexico, the more people are like, "Fuck you, Trump! I'm going to vote for this Mexican movie that I love."
Yes, and I think, you know, I think that the more the caravan is this like outrageous, you know, to the extent that the caravan becomes this outrageous, like phony outrage thing that Trump uses whenever he sees enthusiasm dwindling, you know, Roma and Yalitza specifically, I think, do represent a little bit of like a pushback against that type. You know, this whole movie is about the humanity, insisting on the humanity of indigenous Latin Americans. And to the extent that those people are being dehumanized by the president of the United States to score cheap political points, you know, I think that there's a part of Hollywood that's kind of like, we have to make this happen. Like, we can't overlook this because we just like really think that Melissa McCarthy's cool or whoever it is that's also on the bubble. But I don't know.
I mean, I don't want to speak for all of you, but it seems like we have kind of passed through the membrane of the Netflix thing. Like, it feels like we all are now just assuming that that movie is going to be like in the Best Picture race. You know, I think Mudbound obviously greased the wheels for it, and Mudbound got an acting nomination. So, yeah. Like, it's not unheard of. So I feel like that sort of narrative, in a way, has already been settled.
Well, but also, like, Mudbound is Dee Reese, who's super cool, but, like, Cuarón is, you know, like,
they love
has an enormous history at the Oscars, right? I mean, this is a very, very proven entity. And so I don't think you can look away from it just because it's Netflix. And I, you know, and at some level, I think it represents what's the ultimately good side of Netflix for creators in the film world, at least, which is, you know, they plunk down a lot of money to make a very kind of, you know, personal artistic film that with not huge commercial prospects without them stepping in to do it. So I think that there will be, for every person who's like, oh my God, Netflix is eating my lunch, I feel like there's going to be other people who are like, great, like, sign me up.
Yeah. They also just like had big parties at festivals and like did a lot of screenings and are all, you know, the movie for always felt like, it never felt like a movie you'd watch on your computer. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
In your sort of mind. So I think that it was effective.
Look, they are flooding the zone with, you know, stuff, with people and films and events and, you know, promotion. Like, they're very aggressively moving in this space. So I don't think that – I think that, you know, to some extent, it's 100% true that there are people who are scared of them or wary of them. But I also think that, you know, they're certainly not letting that stop them from advancing their goals. And I feel like, you know, I don't think you can dismiss Roma on any level, you know, as a film that is one of the best films of the year. Unless you just say, like, I don't know, it's just long and boring and in a foreign language and black and white. But that's a pretty, like, dumbass point of view to have. And family members don't like to be in that position.
Someone will come up with it, but it doesn't have to be us.
You know, you mentioned sort of the strategy that Netflix is working on. And how much of this do we lay at the doorstep of, is it Lisa Tabak? Tabak? I don't even know how to pronounce
her name. Tabak, I always
thought. Tabak, okay. You know, who had a long run at the Weinstein Company and was recently hired by Netflix as their strategist. And it's like, I'm like, oh, okay. All right, then. Okay, Netflix.
Yeah, no, they're not playing around.
You know.
They are reassembling the super friends of award strategy over there. I mean, you know, they got Cynthia Schwartz. I think, you know, they have a huge operation. A number of people who used to work for Harvey, you know, and like, sadly, Harvey kind of invented and this whole thing. So they have several, you know, kind of inevitably they have several people who worked for him. Yeah, I mean, they're taking it very seriously and they're investing in it. There's no question about it.
It's sort of like, I think we've talked about this before. Like, I've heard that Netflix is hiring up like all the publicists in the world. I know this to be true. And they're hiring up all the I've heard from sound people that they're hiring all the sound people. And it's just sort of like, it's almost like, we've talked about this before, I know, but it's almost like Netflix is hiring everyone. So it's not just that they have the best people, but no one has anyone left to do work for them. You know what I mean? It's just
Hollywood as a zero sum game.
It's okay. Here comes Disney Go to do its best.
It's sort of a tangent, but like it's been interesting watching this week and last a little bit that like how big of a push A Quiet Place is doing. Speaking of awards marketing, I mean they yeah. sent an email out. They have like 15 or 20 screenings scheduled in LA and New York and London.
Yeah.
In the next few weeks. So it's just fun to watch all that stuff kind of churn into being and be like, oh, this movie is throwing it in the mix. I remember yeah. like a couple years ago getting a screener for Fast and Furious, and it was like one of the, I think it was 7 or something, and it like had like For Your Consideration and like all these categories. It was like, all right, cool, like they're gonna go for it, you know?
Yeah.
They're running all the Quiet Place actors and supporting. By the
yeah,
way.
No, yeah. Well, I was gonna say while we're still on Best Actress, like the fact that they're doing all the Quiet Place actors and supporting seems explicitly because Emily Blunt's gonna run for lead in Mary Poppins, like, and which seems like she has a pretty good shot. Not many people have seen it yet, but on paper, it seems perfect.
For the Globes, at least, right?
Yeah. Oh, definitely. Yeah. I mean, I don't know. Like that, Julie Andrews won an Oscar for it, and people love Emily Blunt. It seems entirely possible to me. So we were going to talk about Best Actor, but obviously Best Actress has our hearts too much. So we'll get into that next week. Bradley Cooper, your time will come next week. In the meantime, that does it for this week's Little Gold Men. Thanks for listening. Thanks for continuing to find us on Apple Podcasts, leaving us ratings and reviews, helping us find new listeners in this exciting season. You can find us all on Twitter at Little Gold Men and on our own. I'm at Katie Rich. Richard?
Rylaws.
And Joanna?
Joe wrote this.
And Mike?
Mike is Mike _ Hogan. I'm speaking for him on his behalf. I have his permission.
This episode was edited and produced by Danielle Roth, and this week's award for the best alternative to the Rotten Tomatoes tomato meter goes to Mike Hogan.
So should they bring a date or not?
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.